Blog Talk Radio.
This is Leslie Gist. I'm here tonight with a special guest, Professor Elwood Watson.
Hello?
Are you on the line, Professor Watson?
Yes, I am. I'm on the line right now.
Please record your message.
When you
finish recording, you may hang up.
Yes, I hear a message.
More options.
Hold on.
To leave a callback number, press 5.
Okay.
I'm here.
Okay. All right. Professor, do you mind me calling? What are you comfortable with me
That's
calling
fine, Professor.
You?
Professor Watson, whatever you want to call me, Professor.
Okay, Professor Watson. I noticed that you have a book. You have several books. I'll
Correct.
Let you introduce yourself, and could you tell the audience a little bit about your projects, your latest
hi.
One?
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for allowing me to, speak to your audience. I appreciate that very much. And I have several books one monograph and several edited works. My first edited work was a co-edited anthology entitled "There She Is, Miss America: The Politics of Sex, Beauty, and Race in America's Most Famous Pageant." And it was a collection of essays, and it looked at various aspects of the pageant, racial aspects of the pageant, like Vanessa Williams, images of black women and their body images, and, you know, the racial historical images of black women's bodies as opposed to white women's bodies and the likes. So we had a pretty good collection of essays on that one, and that was published several years ago by Palgrave Macmillan. My next book was anthology. It was entitled "Searching the Soul of Alan McBeal: Critical Essays." That dealt with a former television show that came on Fox in the late '90s, and it was stayed on for several years until 2002. It was looking at a collection of essays on Alan McBeal, and there were a collection of contributors who looked at it from different aspects of gender, race, and cultural and other ways as well. Then my third project dealt with a co-edited anthology on Oprah Winfrey entitled The Oprah Phenomenon, and I think that title speaks for itself. We looked at the various phenomena of Oprah and the phenomena that she is as an individual and the impact that she had had on all aspects of American society, whether it be media, education, the arts, spirituality, business, wherever there's Oprah's there. She's made her imprint on every aspect, we would say, pretty much in American society. So it was a collection of essays that dealt with America, that dealt with Oprah Winfrey. And I just did a recent anthology and dealt with masculinities, and it was entitled Pimps, Wimps, Studs, Thugs, and Gentlemen: Essays on Contemporary Masculinity and Culture. And again, there was a number of contributors, and I had a particular essay myself on O.J. Simpson, and my essay, particular essay looked at how he had been, I would say, racialized, tabloidized, and sexualized by the mainstream media, and part of it was of his own doing as well. And my monograph, my first book, my own solo authored work, is entitled Outsiders Within: Black Women in the Illegal Academy After Brown v. Board. and that was my first monograph, which came out last year, which looked at black women lawyers such as Anita Hill, Patricia Williams, Lonnie Guinier, Kimberly Crenshaw, and other prominent black women scholars.
You have reached the maximum time permitted for recording your message. If you're
okay.
satisfied with the message, press 1. To listen to your message, press 2.
Is that your phone or my
you're
phone?
You have pressed an incorrect key. If you're satisfied with the message, press 1.
One
to listen
phone.
To your message, press
anyone.
2.
Let
to
me call
erase
you,
and re-record,
Lydia,
press 3. To continue
All right.
recording
you
where you left
call
off,
me right back?
Press
I'll
4.
Call you back at 347, yeah. That number.
Okay. Okay. Hello, are you there? Hello? This is the Antique E Show?
This is Brenda.
Hi, Brenda.
How are you?
Great. We're experiencing some technical difficulties with my guest. I guess we can talk until he calls back. Let me hold on 1 second. Let me see if this is him calling in.
Can anyone hear me?
I can hear you. Okay. All right. Sorry about that, Dr. Watson.
No problem.
All right. Now, you had such a extensive list, and I must admit, I like history, but you're starting to sway me into reading more contemporary books. I'm really interested in your books and your topics. You have a vast range. How can one purchase any of these books?
Well, certainly you can go to, I guess, obviously most bookstores carry the books, all the books that I have out now, they're still out and they're still available to be purchased. You can actually go through the publishing houses themselves, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. Those are certainly two avenues to get the books. And your local bookstores. Your local bookstores will certainly provide any of these particular books.
Okay. Just for the record, especially considering that we were cut off, could you just
sure.
Slowly state the title of each
Certainly.
One of your books?
Certainly. As I said, the first book was There She Is, Miss America, The Politics of Sex, Beauty, and Race, and America's Most Famous Pageant. That was the first one. The second one was called Searching the Soul of Allie McBeal, Critical Essays. The third book was called The Oprah Phenomenon.
Okay.
The fourth book was entitled Pimps, Wimps, Studs, Thugs, and Gentlemen, Essays on Contemporary Masculinity. And my monograph, my first solo book, is entitled Outsiders Within, Black Women and the Legal Academy After Brown v. Board.
Excellent. Now, I'd like to hear more about each one of them, but which one do you want to talk about tonight and why?
All of them are interesting, but I'd like to, I guess, particularly talk about The Outsiders Within, given the fact that it was a monograph and it was my first solo authored book, a book-length manuscript, and I was actually derivation of my dissertation when I was in worked on my PhD and finally got it published, after a number of years, and reworked it and got it into publication, and just the length of time and the enjoyment and the support I had in getting this book published, and I thought it's the one that's kind of special to my heart right now.
Okay, what inspired you to write this book? I know you said it was your dissertation,
sure.
but you had a choice, right?
Oh, certainly. What inspired me was really I was in graduate school in the early to mid-1990s. Throughout the 1990s, I started graduate school in 1993, my doctoral program at the University of Maine at Orono. And at that time, there were black women law professors who were on TV with relative frequency. Kimberly Crenshaw, who was one of the individuals I interviewed for this book, who's a professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law School. Lonnie Guinier, who had been nominated at that time by former President Bill Clinton to be a Deputy Attorney General of the United States, and, you know, ran into some controversy. And also Anita Hill, a couple years earlier, who was, you know, called before the Senate chambers to discuss allegations of sexual harassment against then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas. And I noticed there was a common strand between these individuals. All of them seemed to be black women law professors. And I said, well, maybe there's something here. And also at that particular time in America, race and gender were becoming issues that were becoming more and more in the public eye. Andrew Hackard came out with his book, Two Nations, Black, White, Separate, Hostile, and Unequal. Susan Faludi came out with the book Backlash, looking at, you know, the war against American women. Right? That was her title of her book. The L.A. riots that happened at that time, the Los Angeles riots that happened at that particular time. Sexual harassment became a big prominent issue in the news. And there were a lot of things about race and gender that were becoming at the forefront of American society during the early 90s and the 90s. So therefore, I felt the time was ripe to explore the intersection of race and gender, which is what I wanted to combine both. And therefore, this gave me the opportunity, by choosing this particular topic, to explore both avenues.
Okay. What did you discover, which was the most prominent fact that you remember discovering that really floored you once you seen a pattern develop that you never expected?
I guess what really surprised me was the level of hostility, particularly in the earlier. My book primarily looks at the first and second generation of African-American legal scholars to enter the legal academy, black women legal scholars to enter the legal academy. And that starts in, they entered the academy and begin to start entering the legal academy in the 1970s and 1980s. Women like Joyce Hughes, Northwestern University, these are pioneers. And, you know, Tonya Lovell Banks at the University of Maryland School of Law, you know, these women entered at a time when there were very, very few other role models, and many of them had some significant battles to fight. And, you know, they had to fight that chronic bigotry and that chronic, you know, sexism and racism. Being black women, I saw how they had to deal with racism and sexism. As the late legal scholar Pauli Murray, who died in the 80s, she used to call it Jane and Jim Crow. And I saw,
Jane Crow.
She called it Jane Crow. She called it Jane and Jim Crow, because being a woman of color, they had to deal with sexism and racism. So she said it was, you know, Frances Beale herself argued that point too. So a lot of times women of color, black women, Latino women, Asian women, they're also dealing with racism in addition to sexism in addition to racism. And I saw that as a common theme, as I said, the intersection of race and gender in the lives of these women. Now granted, they were in different schools and different places, so the exact experiences they experienced were obviously different. They were not necessarily totally identical, but the fact that all of them encountered racism of some form and sexism of some form was a commonality regardless of what schools they were at. And that seemed to be the dominant theme that ran through each of their lives, and particularly older women as well. The newer generation that came in didn't have it quite as overt, but there were still sophisticated types of racism, became more subtle and manifested itself in sexism in different ways. And some of the women
after
them.
Now, how would you compare the incidents that Lonnie experienced with former President Clinton, the experience of our new Supreme Court Justice
Sotomayor.
Right. And now her name escapes me just that fast. The professor, the lawyer that was involved with this sexual scandal.
Oh, Anita Hill?
Anita Hill. The three of them. You know, I know you didn't write about Sotomayor, but if you can show us how the three had some similarities or stark differences.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, actually, before I go any further, I want to let you know, I did a column about Sonia Sotomayor on the Academy Speaks, which is a website of Diverse Magazine. It's called, it used to be called Black Issues in Higher Education Magazine. Now it's called Diverse Issues in Higher Education Magazine. There's a website called theacademyspeaks.com, and I'm one of their bloggers, so I actually did an article on her back in June. So if anybody wants to see it, it's there to see. But so what I would say is that
did she experience anything different because she was Latino? You think that?
No, I think she figures. I think she. Well, given the climate of immigration in this country right now, I think some people argue she had. I would say that she did not. I think she figured she faced the same racism and sexism that many of the her black women sisters face. I think there was some degree of xenophobia there on some people who definitely are hostile toward. There are some Americans who believe that the original Americans were black and white. And, you know, that's certainly not my opinion by any means, not at all. But I do think there are some people who felt that, you know, with the attacks on immigration now, I think some people thought she was more of a vulnerable target. There were people, you remember, there were some of her record was questioned. There were people like Rush Limbaugh, Karl Rove, Glenn Beck, talk show host Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. They questioned her academic qualifications and felt that she
who
was
would you parallel? Who would you parallel to stand in those people's place? For Lonnie and for Anita Hill, did they have the same type of legions that were attacking them?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Lonnie Guinier in particular. Well, look at Anita Hill. Let's start off with her since she was the first one who was in 1991. She, remember, there were a number of people, Phyllis Schlafly, a number of women's groups came out and attacked Anita Hill and questioned her credibility and felt, why did she wait this long? You even had some women, other white women, like Camille Paglia, who came out and, you know, questioned her ability. Some black people, the black community. There were also aspects of the black community who were very critical and upset with Anita Hill for coming out, and which you may be very well aware of, who were upset with Anita Hill for coming forth, and they felt that she should have kept it quiet. She could have let it go. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't necessary. I mean, so there were a number of black, you know, even some black people were upset with her, you know, black women, and particularly black men were outraged with Anita Hill because they thought she was, you know, assisting him, you know, bringing a black man down and others. So there were certain segments of the black community that were also very upset with Anita Hill, but particularly the white conservative community and right Republicans and others. You know, her, you know, she, there were, you know, allegations about it that she was, you know, a woman of, you know, questionable character and the like. So she had a number of people who were definitely, you know, a number of groups that came out against her and attacked her credibility and the like. And
was Howard Stern one of them? You know how you mentioned Glenn Beck for today.
Right. Howard Stern, no, I don't think, I'm not sure he quite really, or at least I'm not aware. I don't think he really
okay.
got involved. Howard Stern is the kind of talk show, he's not so much into the politics, he's more into dealing with, you know, the culture, and he doesn't really, it's very seldom does he ever get into politics. He gets into, like, Hollywood celebrities and the more of the...
Was Imus on the air during that time? I'm trying to...
Yes, I think he was just about, he was in his early years at that time. I don't remember him having too much to say about her either, if I can recall correctly. This was about, we're talking about a better part 20 years ago. But
right.
I think he was, you know, at that time, but he was as well. But I think as far as, like, Clint Bolick, I mean, there are people, you know, a number of conservative organizations in particular, you know,
mm-hmm.
who really went after her. Arlen Specter now is a Democrat, but he was a senator from Pennsylvania at the time, who really became very angry with Anita Hill. You remember he said her testimony was flat out perjury. It wasn't true. He just totally dismissed her whole her argument. He thought she had no credibility. And that got a lot of women angry. Even women, white and black and others, got really, really angry. And he almost lost the Senate race that following year in Pennsylvania, because that was also, a lot of people argued that because of Anita Hill's treatment and also about the issue of sexual harassment and white male domination in the Senate to the forefront. And that was, you know, 1990 year was actually considered the year of the woman. The year of the woman. There were a number of women who ran for office across the country and became senators. And a few became governors. Carol Moseley Braun, former senator from Illinois, first black woman to enter the U.S., you may become a U.S. senator, you know, for the United States. She was Illinois. And there were a number of women across the country, you know, Patty Murray of Washington, Dianne Feinstein of California, Barbara Boxer of California.
What about our vice president nominee?
The Republican vice president nominee?
Yes.
Sarah Palin. I think in some areas she faced some sexism, yes. I think she also faced some elitism by that she doesn't have the quote on. She didn't go to – I think some of the mainstream media looked at her as being I think she didn't necessarily have, quote-unquote, the right credentials for the presidency. I think a lot of people thought she was, you know, anti-intellectual. You know, she didn't have Ivy League degrees. You know, they thought, I think there are people who also, cause I think you find those, as I call them, the multiple isms. They're all, it's not just racism, sexism. There's some other issues there too. But I do think the media did engage in some sexism towards Sarah Palin on some level, in the sense that they spent a lot of time worrying about her wardrobe and how much money she spent on clothes. And, you know,
and what about Saturday Night Live?
She volunteered to do that. I think they, in all fairness, Saturday Night Live, I think they made fun of all the candidates. I think all the candidates themselves went on Saturday Night Live. John McCain, Barack Obama, Sarah Palin, you know, Mike Huckabee, whoever was running at that time, a number of them went on Saturday Night Live and made fun of themselves. So I think Saturday Night Live made fun of everybody, in all fairness. I don't think they really singled her out any more than they did any other candidate. You know, you had asked me about Lonnie Guinier earlier. Guinier, yes, I think she ran into some problems as well. You remember the Clinton administration really didn't come to her defense like they did. And there was
No, not at all.
Of the, Exactly. At the Institute for American Justice, remember they called her Quota Queen, and she had a quote-unquote strange name and strange hair and all these kind of things. And those were like code words for exotic and, you know, particularly not white. And I think that they thought she was, they made all these kind of outlandish organizations about her, and it resulted in Bill Clinton withdrawing her nomination. He ended up withdrawing her nomination. And
he also was upset with Little Sister Soldier at the time. I remember those two incidents.
Exactly. Exactly. He made a comment about Sister Soldier. You remember he compared her to David Duke, didn't he? Which I thought was insane. But I think many people argue that was an attempt to try to appease the white Southern base or the white moderate, you know, base of the middle class, white middle class voters, the conservative voters anyway. That, you know, we understand your needs, your fears, and your concerns. And I think that was a political ploy to do that.
Okay. And Geraldine Ferraro. I couldn't think of her name earlier.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. That's what you were thinking. Okay. Geraldine Ferraro. Yeah, Geraldine Ferraro ran for the she was nominated for vice president by Walter Mondale in 1984. And
okay.
As you know, we're talking about 25 years ago, you know, in the mid-1980s, I was a teenager then. But, yes, I do remember that. She ran into a lot of problems, I thought, at that time. But also, a lot of it was financial. I remember because she was Italian-American, there was questions about whether her husband related to the mafia and just these kind of, you know, racially long-held stereotypes. And I think that I think, you know, they went after her family, and I think I thought the media was very, very tough on her on several levels. And I think also she was the victim of a lot of situations. Walter Mondale was not necessarily a very popular Democratic nominee for president. He didn't have the popularity. Ronald Reagan was a very, very popular Republican president. The economy was very strong. The mood of the country was very, very conservative at that particular time. So I think there were a lot of factors to work against her as far as, you know, her and, you know, going to be successful. You know, she had a running mate that was not necessarily the strongest candidate.
Now, who do you think overcame the most obstacles throughout their career, and that you think we should model, use as a model for any upcoming lawyer and female politician?
You mean within my book or in general?
Within your book.
Oh, I would say within my book, of all the women I interviewed, and the one I thought who had the most stirring life story, I would say, was Joyce Hughes. I think she overcame a lot. You know, she had personal sicknesses. She suffered some other illness along the way, but she's still there. She's still at Northwestern. She still persevered, and, you know, she was fighting a lonely battle by herself, you know, in the early 1970s, and I think she was able to, you know, soldier on and reign victorious. I mean, she's a survivor. I mean, you want to talk about anybody who's a survivor, it's Joyce Hughes. I think she was definitely.
And where is she working now?
Northwestern University School of Law, Northwestern.
Oh, okay. We're down to 7 minutes. Do you believe that?
Already? Oh, my. Okay.
Okay. I wanted to make sure I get this question before the interview is over.
Sure.
First Lady Michelle Obama.
Yes.
You have no one to compare her to because she's first African-American First Lady. Right. What do you say about her career prior to becoming the First Lady, and what do you foresee in her future as far as the obstacles and the two young daughters and, you know, being the housewife and the ambassador?
Oh, well, I think Michelle Obama's a powerhouse in every sense of the word. I think she's, you know, very intelligent, attractive. You know, she's the whole package. I think she's, you know, a very disciplined woman. She seems to be an excellent mother. All indications show she's a very attentive, caring, loving mother. I think she's, you know, a brilliant woman. You know, I think she's a classic example of someone who, you know, grew up, you know, from a modest background and has been able to achieve significant, you know, she's a significant achiever. I think she's definitely concerned about those who are less fortunate. I think she comes from humble roots, and she hasn't forgotten that fact. I think she's very, very, you know, altruistic and concerned about others. And I think, you know, she's, you know, very, very health-conscious person. I think there's a number of things about her. I really think there's not enough good things to say about her. I think she's a great person on every level, and I think she's a wonderful role model. As far as her future, I think she I think it's pretty bountiful. I think whatever she wants to do, I think she's going to have a lot of options to do it. I think she can make a very good impact as First Lady. Even when her husband and her husband leave office, I think she'll still be one of those First Ladies that will definitely be very active in the public arena. You know, we saw Betty Ford was still active after she left.
Do you think she should run the way Hillary ran?
I think that would be true. I really can't answer yes or no. I think that's something she would pick herself. She doesn't strike me as somebody who would be. I don't know, but she doesn't strike me as somebody who would be interested in running for president. She strikes me as somebody who would be interested in working from the inside and behind the scenes. I think she strikes me as somebody who would be more interested in working behind the scenes to affect change as opposed to being out there in that visible leadership position. You know.
She was a lawyer, or she is a lawyer.
She is a lawyer. Yeah, she is a lawyer. Right. Correct.
Okay.
Barbara Law.
Now, your Oprah book.
Yes.
Let's talk about your Oprah book and what you like most about the book, or what was the most complicated or difficult, challenging part about that book?
The challenge about the book wasn't too many challenge about it. It was just the challenge was deciding what essays to use. You know, what essay? There were so many good articles. I mean, so many contributors submitted so many good essays, provocative essays, and very good essays. And we had to narrow it down. Obviously, you can't use everyone's essay, so we had to be very limited. We ended up using 14 essays in all. You know, we had about 100 and some submissions, so we had to, you know, very narrow it down. So that was one of the hardest things, to decide what essays we were going to use and include in the anthology. It was really the diversity with Oprah, you know, issues on, you know, there's a chapter in there on the cattle ranchers when, you know, she was taken to court by the cattle ranchers in Texas about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, in the late 90s. There's also an essay there about the spirituality.
Okay, I have a question and a comment about the cattle lawsuit.
Right. Yes.
And this is when she met with Dr. Phil. Correct.
You think about it, Dr. Phil was in the 90s. She was talking. Remember, mad cow disease was going on in England at that time. There was mad cow disease that was taking place, and she saw, I guess, what the effects of beef on a lot of people. What was going on in England? It was, you know, people were dying because of the mad cow disease or getting very, very ill. And she said it has stopped. She goes, I just saw what happened. She goes, it stopped me cold from ever eating another burger. She goes, it stopped me cold from ever eating another burger again. And that's what she did. When she made that comment, apparently the stock market fell. Beef commodities and beef commodities. That just shows you the power of somebody who has that kind of power, that you can disrupt the stock market. And I think they said that the stock market, the cattle rancher stock just fell and plummeted. So I guess a lot of cattle ranchers obviously were angry because they lost a considerable amount of money, and they ended up taking Oprah to court because of this. And that, she reigned victorious because, you know, they blamed her for disrupting the cattle ranchers market, the market. And, I mean, quite frankly, think about it. There's no logic in what they're assuming. I guess you really can't sue somebody for saying, I'm not going to eat another hamburger. I mean, I can say I'm never going to eat pizza again. You know, you know,
right.
You can't sue me for saying that. If pizza, I could sue me if people say they're going to stop eating pizza because I said that. You know, well, there was really no concrete law there, any kind of legal avenue there. So that's what happened there with that. And there was an essay written on that. There was also Oprah and black women, Oprah, her appeal to white women. There were a number of essays in there that we chose, and I think they were really, really provocative and diverse. You know, very, very good open religion. There were a number of them as well.
What about her her broadcasting in all of the different entities of communication she owns? Did you guys talk about that?
Yeah, the Oprah Network, you know, she's got the Oprah. She's starting a radio station. I think it's going to another one in January, I believe. It's going to open up in January. But she has her, you know, she's part of the Oxygen Network. You know, she has her and two other women, I forget the other women, but they're partners. But, I mean, like I said, Oprah's pretty much everywhere. You know, I mean, Oprah Winfrey is a phenomenon. That's why we titled the book Oprah, The Oprah Phenomenon. You know, she is, you'd be hard-pressed not to find any area of American society, as I said, whether it's business, religion, academia, the arts, you know, the publishing world, literature world. I mean, look at her right now. Her books, if she recommends a book, you know, she's got, 20 million, they call it Oprahaholics, 35 to 30 million Oprahaholics every day who watch her. You know, 5 or 6 million are going to go out and buy the book. You know,
right.
So I'm saying, you know, she can make you a best selling author. I mean, so she's definitely,
an icon,
a phenomenon, an icon, you know.
And you know, I have a picture. She has a fundraising or some sort of gathering at her house with a bunch of women, black women.
Okay. Yeah.
And
several years ago, I think a couple years ago, about 3 or 4 years ago, she I think very influential, prominent black woman. I think it was a number of stars. There was her, Maya Angelou, Angela Bassett, Gladys.
I posterized that picture with all.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yes. What can you tell me about that gathering she held at her home? Has anything like that has ever been done in history?
I'm sure there have been similar events like that have been done. That particular event, all I know was that there were a number of prominent black women who attended, you know, that she invited and attended the ceremony. But there have been a number of, you know, women who've gotten together over the years, you know, women have the women's conferences and, you know, prominent women of note, you know. So it's not the first time something like that's happened, but I think it might be the first time that so many prominent influential black women have gotten together, you know, and have been, you know, so showcased so highly. I think that might, to my knowledge, that may be the first one, unless there's, you know, a number of black women conventions, historical conventions where it happened. But I think none of them probably, you know, at that time would have gotten the visibility of this particular event because the mainstream media actually covered this event.
Right. Well, we're down to our last minute. Could you please tell the audience how to contact you and to how they can purchase your book again?
Certainly. My book, like I said, there's several books. Like I said, one thing, my name is Elwood Watson again, Elwood Watson. I'm a professor of history and African-American studies and gender studies at East Tennessee State University. My email address, if you want to contact me there, that would be great too as well, is Watson, with an E on the end, Watsone, at etsu.edu, like education. Watsone at etsu.edu, like education. You can also purchase my books from Amazon.com, and you can also purchase them from Barnes & Noble and any local bookstore. I'm in the process of updating my own personal website, so you can also, within by the end of this month, you can also go to my personal website, and you will see you'll see photographs of each one of those books on the website as well. But like I said, go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble and type in Elwood Watson, my name, and you'll see all those books that will come up. And any local bookstore will be able to carry them as well.
Okay, we have a few callers on the line. Although the show is not streaming live any longer, we do have callers on the line. Callers, you have the chance to ask Dr. Watson a question. Do you have any questions? No questions. You guys are shy. All right. Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Watson, for being a part of our show. It was very informative. It went so fast. I hope that you will visit us again in the near future.
I'd love to.
Okay, and again, we look forward to talking to you again, and we'll keep in touch.
Yeah, I'd love to, and thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Okie dokie. Have a good night.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You have been forwarded to a voicemail system.